Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. From our workshops in Juneau, Alaska and London, England, we get together on the Echolink system to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
KL7R, KL7R, M0HBR, are you there, Mike?
Yeah, M0HBR, KL7R. Good morning, Bill. It's 9:45 here in Juneau, and we had a gorgeous day today. Temperatures were just slightly below freezing, but the sun was out, and frost was out. Definitely a beautiful, clear fall day. So have you fallen back on your clock there, Albert?
Yes, we have. Daylight savings time has hit in the UK. We are back on GMT. British summertime is behind us. It's 0544 on the 29th of October 2006. That makes this Solder Smoke number 37 for those who are keeping count. Mike, we have a lot of technical topics to discuss today, two big projects, one in Alaska, a smaller project here in London, but I have to start with kind of an ethical, moral question for you. Do you think it's wrong for a home brewer to own more than one copy of Solid State Design for the radio amateur? Do you think there is a moral issue here, Mike, KL7R, M0HBR?
Well, I saw your mail message there that you had scored a second one for a ridiculously low price, and I don't think it's wrong to own one, but it might be wrong to gloat there, over.
No, I'm not gloating. I was torn by it. It arrived in the mail. It all started with a posting on QRPL. A guy, I forget his call, forgive me, but noted that there was a kind of a bookseller on the web that had one. And I may have been taking advantage of my early wake up in comparison to the East Coast, but I got right on the web and I bought it. And when it arrived, I felt guilty because now I have two of them sitting here. But I'm going to assuage my guilt a little bit and rationalize the purchase by saying that the first one that I have has been exposed to many years of tropical humidity in the Dominican Republic and is in really bad shape. So I'm going to tell myself that I really need one. And I want to point out to our listeners that this is not an attempt to corner the market and drive up the price on Solid State Design for radio amateurs. I just got a second one, and it arrived, and it's in great shape. There's not a mark on it, so I think I'm good for another 30 years or so of home brewing with that wonderful book. Not to take anything away from experimental methods, but we've discussed this, and I seem to have a kind of nostalgic attraction to Solid State Design. But, well, enough of that. On to current projects. And I was looking at your journal on your website, Mike, and you have an amazing picture there of your homebrew manual spectrum analyzer. And let's discuss this project, because this is a real beauty as far as I'm concerned. KL7R, M0HBR.
Well, about QRPL, I don't take the mail directly. I take it. I read it on the web, and it's like long delayed echo there, and it's, you know, like 4 hour or 2 hour delay, and I think the guys that get their mail undelayed have a better shot at getting the cool gear that shows up there once in a while. Well, yeah. So I got some crystals in. I kind of had this thing in the back of my mind for a while. For those that are interested, if you go to kl7r.ham-radio.ch and click on journal, you'll see it in there. You'll see a link to it. But I got some crystals in, and so I spent some time with chapter 3 of experimental methods and learning how to characterize crystals. I'd never done that before. You said you'd done that, and so I once I got the crystal parameters for the 10 meg crystals I had, I wanted to make a sideband filter, and so I designed a 50 ohm in, 50 ohm out, 3 dB bandwidth, Butterworth 10 megahertz crystal filter using AADE crystal design software, and I made it a little module so that I can plug it into to other radios like maybe the BitX20 or whatever. So I'm going to turn it over, but I've been thinking for a while how I could use my DDS30 AMQRP made a direct digital synthesis, and I have a DDS30 SIGGENT. And I was thinking about how would I use a mixer with a DDS30 to make a tunable direct conversion receiver that I could listen to my harmonics with, and measure power levels of harmonics. And it wasn't until I thought about it a while and realized that I needed to put a filter to select the harmonic rather than just do a DC receiver. That thing started making sense to me, and I was able to bolt a couple things together and make a manual spectrum analyzer that I was able to read the harmonics generated by a little amp that I built there, M0HBR KL7R.
Yeah, and I'm looking at it. It's really, you've got so many neat things on the picture there. First of all, I'm very jealous about the W7ZOI, W7PUA, power meter that you have there, and the step attenuator. I need one of those too, and the DDS30. Yeah, well, that too. I see you've got the RCA plugs there, and we won't hold that against you, Mike. There was your use of that particular connector provoked some expressions of concern from the solder smoke community, but it seems to work just great. It looks good, and so this looks like a really neat setup. So you can use the filter there, and all kinds of applications for this thing. Have you thought about instead of taking the output to the power meter? One thing that I thought about was maybe take it and put it to some sort of digital analog to digital capture thing. I have one of these little Radio Shack and DVMs here that allows a digital output to a computer, so you could graph it, and then you might be able to take this. Take it one step further and come up with some neat graphs and digital readouts and everything. But it just looks neat the way it is. So congratulations, KL7R M0HBR.
Yeah. Well, the CNC connectors. You ridiculed me so hard, and Kay sent me a care package. So I replaced the RCA jacks with BNC connectors. So I no longer have to no longer have to justify using the RCA jacks. Those are actual BNC connectors, and all the cables were BNCs. And that step attenuator was given to me by a ham that left town, and he had two of them, and both of them were shot, and I was able to pull them apart and salvage switches from one enough to make one of them work. If you look on the W7ZOI power meter, there's a little thing right underneath the analog meter there, and that's a feed-through capacitor, and it reads out a voltage, a linear voltage that's relative to the logarithmic power. I probably didn't say that right, but basically you can hitch that up to a voltmeter. If you've got a voltmeter, you can hitch it up to that there pin, and then graph all you want. If you've got some way to output those voltages to a computer, but. Yeah, so basically you take a local oscillator, you run it into a mixer. I had some ADE1s. A guy was selling them on QRPL, and I bought five of them, little surface mount diode ring mixers. And I put a local oscillator in and RF in, and then IF out. And the IF out goes into a crystal filter and a 10 meg crystal filter. And the output of the crystal filter goes into the meter, which reads directly in dBm. And it uses, but the meter is kind of cool because it uses a chip that reads power and outputs linear volts. The thing reads from like minus 70 dBm to plus 15 or so dBm. And then I've got a little box that puts a 40 dB tap, so you can read up to 100 watts with the thing. But you can read the output of a NE602 oscillator, or you can read the output of a 100 watt amp. What's weird about the power meter is the difference between 1 watt and 5 watt is just a tick or two on the meter, and that's a little hard to get used to. It's not a good meter for adjusting high power, small differences in high power amp. It's a good meter for setting up oscillators and getting stage gain like a 10 dB gain of an amplifier. You could measure directly with that thing. But the concept of this is that you set the DDS30 SigGen to 10 megahertz above the frequency you want to measure. So if you had a 4 meg oscillator or 4 meg amplifier that was running 4 meg, you could set the SigGen to 14 meg and read the power. And you could go up to the second harmonic, which would be 8 megacycles, so you'd set the SigGen to 18, and the third one would be 12, so you'd set it to 22, and you could read the power directly off the power meter. So I've been thinking a good Christmas gift for you would be for me to build you one of these power meters, but I don't know, I've never sent you anything there. M0HBR, KL7R.
KL7R, M0HBR. Yes, well, we want to encourage that kind of thinking. And if there's anybody else out there who would like to send me things too, that'd be fine also. No, I'm just kidding. But nice of you to think about that. But Wes, in one of his emails, mentioned the need for a power meter for those of us in the QRP, in the QRP game, especially the old we're often trying to measure things at levels where the old RF probe trick with the diode and the capacitor just doesn't quite do it. I think we should mention that that Kanga sells a kit. Kanga sells a kit for the power meter. So, folks who are interested might want to take a look at their website. My test gear is at the far opposite end of the sophistication spectrum, Mike. I have an RF probe that I built into a small, I guess it's about half inch piece of PVC pipe, and it's got the diode and the resistor and the capacitor in there, and the it's got like a little piece of a nail sticking out the front, and that's the probe. And I do a lot of my RF measurements with that thing. But when you get down to really, really low power levels, of course, you need something more sophisticated. So that beautiful power meter there looks like just it's the business, as the Brits would say. By the way, I really am also envious of your 10 megahertz crystal filter there. You actually characterize the crystals as they recommend. I did not. I built one of these when I was building my I guess I built a couple of them. One when I was building my W1FB bare bones superhet, aka Barbados receivers. For 20 meters, one of my favorite designs by Doug DeMart used dual gate MOSFETs, 40673s, and it had a crystal filter at 3579 kilohertz, 3.579 megs, and when I got to the part of the project where I was going to build a filter, I looked at the gear that you needed to characterize the crystals, and the test gear that they were recommending was more complicated than the receiver itself. So I kind of wrung my hands about that for a while, and then finally just decided to give it a go, as they would say here. And I had a big bag of, I mean, literally a paper bag full of 3579 Colorbrose crystals. And I think I just tried to, just by ear, tried to find a number of them that were very, very close in frequency. I just ran them with little test oscillators. So we got the frequency close. And then in terms of the input and output impedances, I just used whatever Doug had in his circuit. It seemed to work out okay. I'm sure if I ran it through a sweep generator or something, it would show some horrible ripples at the top of the bandpass, but it worked for me, and I got the single signal effect and lost the other sideband, so the 20-meter CW band became half as busy as it had been when I was running it without the filter. So that was fine, but fine on characterizing the crystal. So, yeah, a big success there at KL7R. Congratulations, KL7R M0HBR.
Roger. It turns out that I didn't have to be that, picky about all that. And it also turns out that the software, the AADE filter design software, has some default parameters for 10 meg crystals, which were within, 10% of the parameters that I found. So actually, I could have skipped all that work, but I didn't figure it was wasted work. And I built a little circuit that allows me to test the crystal filters. And I went through the process. It wasn't wasted work, I don't think. I guess it's good to know that the AADE software is right, and I don't need to do that anymore when I'm using 10 meg crystals. When I go to a different frequency, I may have to do some further research. So I hear you've that's the main thing I had going on here is that wound up being my work for the week, those two items. So now that I got a spectrum analyzer, I can start designing amplifiers and measuring low pass filters and seeing if they work and stuff like that. I hear you've been working on an amp there, Bill. M0HBR KL7R.
KL7R M0HBR. Yeah, your comment made me think that with the kind of rigs I've been building and the kind of approach to homebrewing that I've been following, I'm almost afraid to have a spectrum analyzer here. I'm afraid about what it might reveal when I read the articles by the heavy hitters in the homebrew area and the care they take with IMD and spurious products and all that. I'm put to shame because I'm in the basically put it together and see if it works, and if the other guy can hear me, then it must be okay school. I suppose I should live in fear of the telecommunication authorities kicking my door down one of these days. I'm trying to improve. I really am. And that's what I've been working on this week. A really simple RF amplifier. I've been trying I've been for a long time struggling with the kind of the design parameters for amplifiers. How do you select the load? How do you determine the input impedance? How do you set up the biasing? These kind of really basic questions that I somehow have skimmed by and didn't get a real good understanding of as I developed as a home brewer. Well, it's time to go back and learn these things and really understand how these different component values are selected when you're designing an amplifier. So I've been making use, of course, of the wisdom in solid-state design and experimental methods, and I started using the software in the back on the CD-ROM that comes with experimental methods. I found that very useful, and there's been some really great and inspirational messages from Wes, W7ZOI. The way I did this little amp is I just started out, I guess, with a piece of paper and just started doing the calculations for how much how much DC input I would need. My objective was to go from about 50 milliwatts. I have 50 milliwatts coming out of this little ceramic oscillator buffer amplifier arrangement that I've been playing with. It's at on 20 meters. It's around 14.3 megs. I wanted to take that, see if I could build an amplifier, just one stage, and take it up to half a watt. So to go from 50 milliwatts to, you know, 500 milliwatts to half a watt, a 10 dB jump, to see if I could do that. And I made it even simpler, but at the same time more difficult, by putting a couple of constraints on it. I wanted to keep it Class A, completely Class A, no Class AB or anything like that. I wanted to do it without feedback and just keep it as simple as possible. So I started out with a pen and paper and just did some calculations on how much input I would need, how much input power I would need, DC input, then what kind of load I would need to have the half watt output. Kind of got into the formulas too. You know, a lot of times when you're reading through the articles and the books on this, the formula comes up. The formula that keeps coming up is the VCC minus VE squared over 2 times the power output. And I really didn't want to just sort of plug and play with that. So I fooled around with the equations quite a bit and got a better sense and kind of got my got a better understanding, I think, of where that formula comes from and why it's used, and the derivation of it. That helped me understand it a lot better. But anyway, I'll make a long story short here. I kind of built it on paper, I guess, and then I went to LT Spice and designed it and built it on LT Spice. And then when it looked like on LT Spice that it would work, then I turned to the workbench and built it on copper-clad board. And I was really pleased because it works as predicted by LT Spice and by my paper calculations. I have a little broadband transformer in the input, and the output network, there's nothing there really. It's just an RF choke going to a resistor of the value that I calculated for the load with a little bypass cap through it. To keep the DC and the RF separated. But hey, it works. It gets real hot in Class A. I can't keep it on too long. It's certainly not useful. I mean, it would need an enormous heat sink. But I watched the output and the scope, and it seems fairly clean. And the power levels are pretty much what the output level is what I expected. One thing I'm kind of curious about is that it just seemed by serendipity to come to be about the amount of gain that I wanted. In other words, I didn't have to play with the input power. You know, when you're not using feedback, the gain is pretty much determined by the transistor's beta. And that makes it tough because you can't really set and specify and fix the gain that you want. I think it's one of the reasons that the feedback is used. But it just turned out that this thing came out with about 10 dB worth of gain. So, voila, there it is. Now, of course, the next steps will be to add some feedback, control it a little bit better, and then maybe change it from this power hog Class A operation to a more reasonable and sensible Class AB for DSB purposes. So that's the. I'm pleased to report that some actual solder was melted in this project, and it wasn't all the kind of virtual designing that I've been stuck in now for the last few weeks. KL7R M0HBR.
Yeah, Roger. Well, you sent me the Spice file, and I'm taking a look at it here. I tried to run it, and I had a problem with the version of Spice that I have. I did not have a 2SC2075. I don't know. You must have imported that device into Spice and figured out how to wire that up. But yeah, the two things that jump out at me here when I'm looking at this is that you've got some real low value biasing resistors. The voltage divider resistors, the high one is 110 ohms and the low one is 47, which is interesting. That's pretty close to 50 ohms. Is that 47 a 50 ohm load, or is it just what you needed for the voltage divider there, Bill? Go ahead.
No, what happened is because I'm running so much standing current through this thing to keep it Class A that it ends up that you're getting quite a bit of base current. So they always recommend that you have to make the biasing network stiff and current. You have to have quite a bit of current going through that in relation to the base current. So I had to pick fairly low values for the bypass network in the base circuit. This results from the large amount of current that I'm running through the transistor. So it wasn't really an effort to do impedance matching. The input impedance of the thing is really very low, much lower than the 47 ohms that I have there in the bypassing network. So that's what really drove it. They weren't selected for input impedance. You've got input impedance, I think, a lot lower, again, because of the large amount of current that I'm running through to keep it Class A. This is really just, I guess, a thought experiment that has moved one stage further onto copper-clad board. But it's certainly by no means an optimal design. I don't think it would even be practical. But I'm having fun with it, and it's always nice when things work on the workbench after LT Spice predicts they will work. And on the transistor, it's actually I didn't have a model at let's see, what is the number here? Let me find a thing. Oh, as a Russell paper, the 2SC 2075. Those are the standard CB radio RF amplifiers, and I had a bunch of them in the junk box. I started out building this thing with a 2N2222, but it killed it almost instantly. So I needed something a little bit more robust. So the CB power amplifier transistor was pressed into service, and I didn't have a model for it. So I just looked through the limited number of transistors that Spice has, and I found one that looked like it had parameters similar to the CB RF amplifier device that I was actually using. So I started out designing with a 2N2222, and when I got to the workbench, I realized that was going to go pop real fast. So I switched to the more robust transistor. But the file that I sent you has a model for some transistor that has parameters that are just way that are similar to the RF amplifier transistor that I'm actually using, but I just changed the label there, and I don't actually have the model for the RF amplifier, the CB transistor, KL7R M0HBR.
All right. Well, there's a lot to learn there. Why did you use a 68 ohm load instead of a 50 ohm load?
Just the formula with the power out formula that I mentioned before said that called for a 68 ohm load. Now you could do a transformer in there, you could do an L network, or you could just leave it as it is since it's close enough. But that's the value that was yielded by the VCC minus VE squared over 2 times the power output. That's what it yields for if you want half a watt out. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I saw you throwing that formula around, and I saw that you had done the derivation for it. I actually am I'm not aware of that formula other than what your mail had talked about. Basically, it's a formula for determining output impedance.
No, not really output impedance. It's load, which is different, as Wes pointed out to me recently. But when I started thinking about how the transistor operates and how the voltage and current variations going through it work, it becomes really apparent that a very important parameter is the value of the load, and for a given output power with a given value of DC from collector to emitter, there's a specific load value that'll yield the power out. It's basically Ohm's law taken a few short steps further, but it's a really important formula. It's used all the time. It shows up all the time in solid state design and experimental methods. And I just wanted to understand it a little bit better. I came up with a kind of a Word document that describes the thought process, and it includes a couple paragraphs in there on the derivation of the formula. I'm reluctant to put something out like this, but Wes took a look at it, and I think he said I was generally on the right track. I might still have some errors in it, but what I'll do is I'll put it up on my blog. If you go to the gadgeteer.us, www.gadgeteer.us website, you'll see there's a link to on my blog. I don't use the blog that much, and I don't think too many people are reading it, but it's a convenient place to post documents like this. And I'll go ahead and post it there when we finish here. Folks can take a look at it. Let me know if I'm off base or totally screwy on this thing. But I think I'm getting close to it, and that's why the actual value came out to be 64 ohms, but I went with 68 because that's a standard value. And that gives you the load there, yeah. So, like I said, just kind of a first round here, and then we'll go to class AB and feedback and all that. But it's been fun. KL7R, M0HPR.
All right. Well, I'm sure I'm going to learn something from your learning here eventually. I'm still a bit hung up on measuring input and output impedances of amplifiers. I played around, before I said I built a return loss bridge, a 6 dB hybrid, and I from that was an experimental method. And I think there's a N5 ESE that built one also on the net. But I never had a chance to use it. I never saw a need for it. But I used it quite a bit, measuring the impedance of the crystal filter that I built. I wanted to design a 50 ohm in, 50 ohm out crystal filter, and I was able to use it to measure the input impedance of the crystal filter, and so there was use for that, and I was able to use it to measure the input impedance of the amp I was working on, and I was kind of surprised with the amp that it was supposed to be a 50 ohm input impedance, but it had a low value input capacitor, and I guess that was to flatten gain. Transistors have higher gain at lower frequencies, and I guess that input capacitor, a fairly low value, was used to flatten gain and drop the gain at low frequencies. But what it also did is it totally messed up the input impedance of the amp. The input impedance was nowhere near 50 ohms at low frequencies. It got fairly close to 50 ohms at high frequencies, higher frequencies, but the impedance went nuts at low frequencies. And I have no idea how to measure output impedance. I've been thinking about that for some time. So this formula you've been using is close to what I want to know, but I'm not sure it's exactly what I want to know. I guess the question I got to know is, do I care about the output impedance of the amplifier, or do I just care about the load and and trying to make the amplifier get close to the load impedance. So, Bill, go ahead.
Well, that's I'm kind of at that point too, Mike, and I think you have to worry about both. And in a recent email, Wes discussed ways that you could test for the output impedance, and I'll send you that. But also on the I noticed in the one of the bits of software in the back of experimental methods, it's called FBA. It's feedback amplifiers, and it allows you to change the values on the feedback loops, in the emitter and from collector to base, and play with it a little bit, and it shows you how the changes affect the input output impedance and return loss going in and out. Right now I've been focusing on the load value and haven't been looking at the issue of output impedance, but I guess that's one of the next things that I have to do as I go through this self-education process. But hey, it's fun. And I wanted to mention one other thing. I don't want to spend too much time on this little experimental amp, but around the same time I was playing with this, there was some interesting email on the experimental methods mailing list, the EMRFD mailing list, from Wes and from Rick Campbell, on the issue of the QST50 challenge and the usefulness or appropriateness of double sideband rakes in this effort. And I thought both messages, the web message from Wes and Rick, were really interesting. Wes points out some of the additional distortion product and IMD product issues that arise when you transmit both sidebands, and I hadn't really focused on that as much, and as a user of DSB, I guess I should have. And I think it raises some really interesting and important technical issues for the users of DSB. And then Rick came in with a very thoughtful message about it, and he talked about the issue of whether, all right, we have these additional IMD products that come up when you transmit both sidebands, but doesn't that also take place with ordinary good old AM when you're also transmitting both sidebands? I think Rick says that he's still thinking about that and doing calculations on it, but he comes down, I think, on the side of DSB being appropriate under certain circumstances, obviously not at high power on a contest weekend, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but certainly it's okay on VHF or on empty bands. And he has a very nice line in one of his messages there. I think something along the lines that he'd far prefer to work somebody on a operating portable from an igloo with a homebrew DSB rig than to listen to an empty, quiet band and background noise, because nobody wanted to put such an impure rig on the air. So I think the attractiveness and simplicity of a homebrew DSB rig is what Rick was talking about. But I thought the exchange was very interesting, and this whole QST 50 challenge is generating a lot of good thought and a lot of good home brewing, I guess. KL7R, M0HBR.
Oh, Roger, Bill. Well, your comments about igloos get close to home there, Bill. Fine on all that. I did have one last thing about your amp that I wanted to mention. Is I found two sites on the net which I added to my biasing bookmark. Both of them involve, this is for measuring output impedance, both of them involve changing in different load impedances, not impedances, different load values, and measuring the voltages to determine the output impedance of the amplifier. You can do that with measure unloaded voltage, measure, you know, 75 ohms, and then measure 50 ohms or something like that. So I wanted to mention that. Yeah, I saw part of the articles you mentioned about, or the comments about IMD and DSB, and, you know, my comment about that is I hacked an HW8, I put it on double sideband, and I was checking in from the bush to Anchorage on, you know, half of 2 watts double sideband, with a watt on one sideband into Anchorage, and Anchorage could hear me better from the Yukon River on double sideband at 1 watt than they could hear me on CW at 2 watts. And so I think Intermod might be an issue, but it's not enough of an issue to stop real communication from happening. I'm not sure Intermod is a is an FCC problem. I don't think the FCC requires you to have low Intermod in your transmit signal. It may be more of an issue for if you were to try to send things like PSK through a DSB rig. But I did that too, and that worked. So I don't know what the actual problem would be, other than wanting to get the most performance possible out of a radio. Hey, I got a couple other items. One is relating to your oiling the clutch on your old Heathkit radio there, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes, the HW101, the only rig that I had to actually change the clutch. I changed the clutch on the transceiver, and I had to change the oil on it every once in a while. We could talk about that, but first, the issue on the IMD with DSB, it's obviously a bandwidth issue. It's splatter. That's what it's about, Mike. And if you're getting a lot of additional IMD products, and you don't have the filter in there. The key is the absence of the filter. That beautiful filter that you designed will knock down a lot of those kind of products. And if you keep the final, it'll knock down a lot of them, and you just don't have it, of course, in a DSB rig. Rick Campbell points out, and this was really interesting to me, was that you also have the same issue to a certain extent in phasing sideband rigs because there's no filter there either. And As a longtime user and current owner of a Hallicrafters HT37 phasing rig, I found those comments really interesting. And Rick points out how the people always like the sound of the phasing rig. I used to love running that HT37 because people just loved how it sounded. But it's an issue there too. So these are interesting topics, and I'm glad to see DSB getting all this this attention. I think the jury's still out. We'll have to wait to see what the real experts have to say on it. But there's some head scratching going on about DSB and its usefulness, which is interesting. In this world of all Yaesu ICOM and Kenwood rigs, it's interesting that the DSB is even being discussed. So it's great. What were you going to ask me about changing the clutch on the HW101? Because I consider myself something of an expert on that particular technical operation, KL7R M0HBR.
Well, I wasn't going to ask. I just had noted that you had done this process. And what I found last week with a fellow out there is, am I alive? My screen went blank, and I thought we lost power here at Juneau again. I should have known that the lights were still on. Anyway, I saw a guy out there on the net using a CD-ROM as a reduction drive. The old Hallicrafters rigs and the Heath rigs had a plastic dial, the edge of which was pressed on by a small shaft, and you basically turn the small shaft, and that would rub on the edge of the plastic circle, and the plastic circle would turn slowly because the small shaft is rotate. You rotate the small shaft 100 times to get the circle to move one rev. And this guy was using the guts of a potentiometer as the small shaft and using a CD-ROM as the plastic dial. And he had a Rev-V that used a small CD-ROM as the reduction gear. And he basically put grommets, plastic rubber grommets, in the center of the CD-ROM to slide it onto the shaft of your cap, of your variable capacitor, and put a grommet on the shaft of the potentiometer to touch the edge of the CD-ROM. And he had a further refinement of heating up a triangular file on his stove and rolling the CD-ROM on the triangular file to get extra traction on the grommet on the pot shaft there, Bill. M0HBR, KL7R.
KL7R, M0HBR, yeah, well, brings back memories, Mike. My problem with the clutch arrangement on the HW101 was actually it had to do with the, there was a little mechanical button right next to the tuning dial, and what you would do is you would press it in, and this would allow you to align the actual frequency of the transceiver with the frequency that was displayed on the little disc that spun around inside. We're a long way from glowing numerals here. but in my experience, the Heathkit HW101, although we love it dearly, and it's the most widely produced HF transceiver ever made, it doesn't age well. I think it was an economy rig, and I think the Heathkit designers tried to keep the cost down wherever they could, and there's a lot of cheap plastic and other stuff in there that just doesn't age well. And I found that the clutch on mine, it's a little piece of plastic in there, and it's actually called the dial clutch, and it got real brittle. And I was working on it one day, and I pressed the button and to hold the dial, and I heard this horrible kind of plastic crack sound from inside the rig, and you know that's not good. And I opened it up, and sure enough, this thing had just shattered. It got brittle over the years, and when I pressed on it, it just kind of cracked into about three or four different pieces. I didn't use a CD-ROM. This might have been, I think, before the days that CD-ROMs existed, although that would have been a good one. And I just found a bit of stock plastic that was above the appropriate rigidity and cut myself out a replacement clutch. And, well, it's sitting in the HW101 that I have here in storage. So, yeah, I replaced the clutch. On the oil, one time I had the VFO was just really squirrely. It was really rough when I turned the thing, and I was jumping around all over the place instead of, you know, tuning smoothly. And I was all set to go in there and tear up the VFO and see if I can get that going right. And luckily, an old timer chimed in over the internet and said, "No, don't do it. Just a couple of drops of oil on the reduction drive, and you'll be all squared away." And so that's what I did, and that did it. So yeah, I changed the oil and changed the clutch on an HW101. Well, okay, Mike, we've been covering a lot of ground here. I want to do a Solder Smoke mailbag today. We've been neglecting that, and we've got a lot of really good mail. I just want to mention something else. I was out, we were up in East Anglia, up in the Cambridge area, on kind of a shopping expedition this week. And I was in the store, and I spotted something that I really didn't need, but I just had to buy it. I guess it was the Ham Radio Instincts. It's for the Wi-Fi network. My wife just got a new laptop, so it's important for us to have a good Wi-Fi network here in the house. And D-Link has this thing in the box, and it's called a wireless range extender. I mean, how can a true radio amateur resist that kind of brutal marketing? I mean, I just had to buy it. I don't know if it'll work. I don't know if I'll be able to set it up, but I just found myself compelled to spend $79 on a wireless range extender. I think it's just the Ham Radio Instincts that kicked in on that. KL7R, M0HBR.
Oh yeah. Unfortunately, it's more like a repeater than it is like a good narrow beam antenna, Bill. So you Oh, this is going to show some bias here. It will appeal to the 2 meter types and maybe not to the to the EME types there, Bill. yeah, go ahead. Get your mailbag ready and I'll turn it over. I just wanted to make a mention that Mars rovers hit 1,000 days. I don't know if it's 1,000 sols. I think it's 1,000 sols on Mars there. I mean, that's and both of them are still alive and doing work. Wow, that's some high tech there that's really paying off there, Bill. Over to you, M0HBR, KL7R.
KL7R, M0HBR. Yeah, well, great. Happy 1,000 sol day for the rovers. I read Steve Squire's book about them, and it just amazing piece of gear. I'll have to put that up on the book page there, because it's a really great book. Okay, listen, I don't have the gong. The kids have taken the gong away. But well, there's a cheap, poor substitute for the gong. That's the lamp. Solder smoke mailbag. We got we've gone a few weeks without one, so I hope we don't miss anybody. But we got a nice email from K, WD0BDK, talking about giving us some recommendations for my new soldering station, echoing Mike's endorsement for Ocean State Electronics, so I'll be getting in touch with them. We've got a really cool email from a very, very great home brewer, Jeff Dam, WA7MLH, and he's got an amazing website. And unfortunately, I don't have the URL here, but I think if you just Google WA7MLH, I'll try to get his URL up on the web. But the call sounds familiar, and I realized that it's a lot of his rigs, especially double sideband rigs, I believe, are in solid state design. He's an old friend of West, W7ZOI. I think he attributes West, as many of us do. He gives him credit for a lot of his interest in home brewing. But we got a really nice email, and he has an amazing website with all kinds of great pictures of really, really, really neat homebrew rigs. Jack, G3PVG, sends in an email with some comments on our discussion of the MOSFETs, and he gives us links to Paul Harden's NA5Ns, a lot of his sites on this topic. So thanks to you, Jack, for that email. Sometimes we get emails from really cool locations, and Walter Wolf, AC4IM, gave us an email, and let's see, I'm trying to get Walter's QDH here. I think Walter. Let me see. Hold on. Walter was at. This is his location in southern Italy at the San Vito Solar Observatory, providing real-time solar data to the U.S. Air Force and its customers. And I just had to say, Walter, you have the coolest job for a radio amateur that I've heard about in a long time. So thanks for the input there from southern Italy, Walter. And keep those sunspots coming. Please do whatever you can to help out in that area. let's see. We got a nice email from Joe, W3JDR. Came in this morning. Joe recommended that I switch from LT Spice to another simulator called Symmetrix, available from a company called Katina. And I just had to say that his message arrived right on the one day that I was able to get the LT Spice working to my satisfaction. So I think I'm going to stick with LT Spice for a while, Joe. But thanks very much for the input. Mike just sent me a text message saying that Jeff Dam's website is, I think it's Neanderthal or Neoanderthal.com. Neoanderthal.com. And if not, I think the call sign will get you there. And then some other emails, as I said, we're catching up. We've had some really interesting exchanges and very nice email from Roger, KA7EXM. and we've been Roger's been helping us sort out some of our URL and RSS feed problems, and in addition, he's provided us some really interesting input on some of his latest projects. Always great to hear from Roger. We've also heard from Gary VK2KYP, who told us how much he enjoyed the interview with Farhan. Rob KL7NA came in. I thought that Rob was a fellow Alaskan. He might be, but he sent us messages from Walla Walla, Washington. Always a good location for ham radio. Jim, another AL7 call. Jim AL7RV called in. Jim and I used to meet quite frequently on Echolink, but we haven't. I think there's been a schedule change here that's kept me away from our Sunday morning QSOs. But Jim reports that he's built his first dead bug transmitter, a W1FB design, an oscillator, a buffer, and a PA on 40 CW. And he's having a blast with it. So great to hear that, Jim, and thanks for the report. Seth, W8FG, sent us a nice email, and he found our discussions of the BitX20 interesting, and he wanted info on the use of nylon spacers in lieu of toroidal cores, or as toroidal cores, and I think Farhan's the expert on that, so if Farhan's listening, maybe we'll get Seth in touch with him on the use of different devices as toroidal cores, an interesting topic. And Chris Reeves sent in an email asking about the ATS-3. Mike had some good info on that, and passed it on to Chris. But keep the mail coming. We really like to get feedback on Solder Smoke, and you can send it to us at Solder Smoke. That's one word at yahoo.com. So Mike, that concludes this issue of Solder Smoke Mailbag. Back to you, KL7R M0HBR.
Yeah, listening to the mailbag, it's kind of amazing what happens out there. You know, you spread it out over a few weeks, and it doesn't seem like a lot, but there really is a lot of really nice feedback we get. I about had it here, Bill. I've enjoyed this one, and so why don't you tie the ribbons on it, and I'll say 73 for tonight. M0HBR, KL7R.
Yeah, time to go, Mike. We're getting close to the 1 hour point here. We'll be filling up those MP3 players. It's been fun, and I really enjoyed looking at your project on the Spectrum Analyzer. Congrats on that, and it was fun to go through the mailbag. It is like I said, that's one of the best parts of doing this is getting feedback from people, and it's a great bunch of homebrewers, and it's always good to hear from people. So 73, have a good evening and a good Sunday tomorrow. Hope everybody copes well with the time change. And yes, we are back on GMT here. It seems just right. Seems right given how close I am to Greenwich. 73, Mike, KL7R, M0HBR.